From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, WUWM's Taryn Powell kicks off a series on what it means to be an American.
Later, a naturopathic doctor was having difficulty treating some of her patients until there was a breakthrough.
We would try something different or we would augment a little bit. They'd do it 110% and they just weren't getting better. And then one of those patients in his home, they found black mold. And that was the boom. That was the moment that it was like, okay.
Later, the Packers bring on Matt LaFleur as their new head coach. Will he be charged with just managing the team better, or is a complete makeover in order?
I want to say both. I guess that's a cop-out answer. They definitely need to alter how they do things. As we saw, Mike McCarthy was the primary play caller for years, and it seems to have gotten a little stale.
Plus, the songwriter behind the new Mary Poppins film. Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tike. When you ask someone what it means to be an American, you'll likely get as many different answers for every person you ask. And that is the premise behind WUWM's new I'm an American series.
Because there's a renewed national dialogue going on about what makes someone an American, this series explores the American identities of people of color from various religious and ethnic backgrounds who are living here in our community.
Today, WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell speaks with Janan Najib of the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition about her family's history in this country.
Well, I have a very interesting history because my paternal grandfather used to come to the United States as a merchant. He used to bring the Oriental carpets and different types of materials and artifacts to sell in the United States. And so he would go to a few different cities, but one of his main bases, interestingly, was Milwaukee. At that time, many times people would go to places or to cities where they knew there were other people from their city or other people that spoke their language, from their heritage. And so there was a very small group of other individuals that lived in Milwaukee. And so this was one of the places that he would come to. And then he brought my father, who was his eldest child, here to the United States when he was about, I think, 15 or 16 years of age to continue his education and to also learn his trade. But about a year after my father came, my grandfather passed away, and he's actually buried in Pine Lawn Cemetery in Milwaukee. But my father remained here, continued his education, served in the U.S. Army. Then he went back overseas to Palestine. He got married. I was born there. My brother was born there. And then they decided that they were going to come to the United States for an extended visit. But then the war broke out in the Middle East, and the Palestinians that were outside the country were not allowed back in by the new Israeli government there.
And I understand you were a child at the time, but do you have any idea of what it must have been like for your family not being able to return home?
I grew up in a family that constantly talked about back home, constantly talked about Jerusalem, constantly talked about the oppression of Palestinians that was taking place, and their concern for family members and their concern for their land and their homes. So that was a constant part of our identity and our existence, and it continues to be.
So speaking of identity, when you talk about your own, how do you describe yourself? Is it by where you come from, your ethnic background, or by your career?
Well, I see myself as an American Muslim woman activist of Palestinian heritage. And so all of those identities are what makes me. That doesn't negate the fact that I also see myself as a mother and a wife and an educator. But I think that a lot of the time, those are the identities that I have to use every day.
So as an American Muslim woman, what are some of the misconceptions you find people to have about the Muslim faith?
I think there are probably two major misconceptions that I encounter. First of all, the idea that Islam is somehow inherently violent, the idea that it's different and not really related to any of the other faiths. So it's important for me to explain the Abrahamic heritage of Islam and its connection to Judaism and to Christianity and the concept of so many of the prophets and the figures that you find in biblical text is also found in the Quran, and explaining the concept of this monotheistic God that we believe in, that is the same God for Christians and for Jews that follow the Abrahamic faith. And so understanding that and understanding the difference between what Islam teaches and what is happening politically in the world. The second major issue that I think that I often have to address is the concept of woman in Islam. People imagine, especially when they see women in traditional Islamic dress, that this must be some type of oppressive practice. Yes. And so, once again, I have to educate. Why, when we see a Muslim woman dressed conservatively, do we automatically assume that they are oppressed? Mm-hmm. Whereas we don't have a problem with the way Amish women dress, with the way Mennonite women dress, with the way Catholic nuns in most of the world dress, mm-hmm. with the way that Orthodox Jewish women dress. Why do we have a different yardstick? Mm-hmm. And so you feel that sometimes when you're talking about this with people that a light bulb goes off that, wow, I just never thought about it that way. And so what we have to look at is, well, let's look at Muslim women, just your neighbors, your colleagues. You know, they're highly educated. Many of them are working. They're family women. They're outspoken. They're involved in their schools. So why don't we ask them, you know, why don't we learn from them?
You talk about the traditional dress of Muslim women. Do you have an experience where you were looked at differently or faced prejudice because of how you dressed?
Most of the circles that I'm in, I really haven't encountered a lot of prejudice. But I can say that definitely there are certain places that I will go that people will be much more friendly than other places. And it's simply because of the way that I'm dressed. And I know it's because of the way that I'm dressed. That hasn't bothered me because I will always find a circle to be with. And I tend to gravitate towards groups that are more social justice oriented and involved in these types of things. But I think one incident that stands out in my mind was actually a number of years ago when my husband and I went to a Packers game, and I was wearing a green and gold scarf, and I had gone to go to the restroom, and I was coming out of the restroom, and a woman, very large woman, started just shouting things at me, saying, you know, this is America. We don't dress this way, and making comments like this. And I was pregnant at the time, and so I'm very outspoken, but the way she was sort of in my face concerned me that if I was going to do something, you know, here I was about 7 months pregnant. I think what bothered me more than her stupid remarks was the fact that the people around her stayed silent. So this, I think, stood out for me that silence, it means you're a part of the problem. And so I did then respond to her because I don't like to let things like that pass. And I said, so what does an American look like? You know, and I said, and what is an American dress like? And, you know, this was a woman, and I don't want to stereotype because there are a lot of great people that have tattoos, but she was tattooed all over, you know, and she was in these large blue jeans that were practically falling off of her. And so, again, I looked at her and I was just like you, you know, I probably could have said something nicer, but so I just then decided to walk away, but I kept sort of looking over my shoulders because, as I mentioned, I was pregnant and I really did not know what to expect. But It wasn't what she said. It wasn't the fact that we do expect stupidity. I mean, stupidity is not against the law in this country. But what bothered me more was the fact that there were at least 20 people standing around and not a single person said anything.
So how do we combat that? What do we say to people who have that sort of prejudicial, racist thinking in this country about the Muslim community?
You can identify a Muslim as much as you can identify an American. They come in all colors, all races, all ethnicities. So, you know.
With that being said, going forward, when you hear the phrase, "I'm an American," what does it mean to you?
That we are part of this great salad bowl where we all have our distinct identity, whether it's our ethnicity, whether it's our race, whether it's our religion, whether it's our political ideology. But at the end of the day, we all are under the same constitution, living in the same country in this democracy together. Being an American is a source of pride. And I think that whenever we travel anywhere, at least when I travel outside the country, I wear it very proudly that I'm an American. And I think we want to be sure that what happens in our country is also something that we're all proud of. And so it becomes a responsibility for all of us to work towards the kind of America that all of us can be proud of.
That was Janan Najib of the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition sharing her story of her American identity. WUWM's I'm an American series will be featured throughout the year.
Coming up next, a look at how household molds can impact your health and the steps you can take to prevent it. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Mold is all around us, from those wet towels stuffed in an old gym bag to the forgotten carton of tomatoes sitting in the back of the fridge. Molds have found a comfortable home in just about every human domain. And depending on who you are, it could be impacting your health.
Jill Krista is a naturopathic doctor based in Janesville, Wisconsin, and she's the author of a new book that deals with the issue of mold-related illnesses. Entitled Break the Mold, the book offers tips on how to deal with mold and how it can impact your health.
Dr. Krista spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and she starts by explaining her approach to healthcare.
So as a naturopathic doctor, I'm trained to find and treat the cause. And most of the time when we can find the cause, whether it's food sensitivities or a lifestyle thing, something maybe genetic you were born with, and we can alter or assist that cause, get rid of the cause, and then alter the body's ability to deal with it, people get better. It's very elegant, and it's participative. And I had this small set of patients where they were doing everything right. I mean 110% right. Not just, you know, most of my patients, they do 80% of it that they were supposed to do and still get better. And these are patients that would just keep coming back, and I can't believe they trusted me to keep coming back. We would try something different or we would augment a little bit. They do it 110% and they just weren't getting better. And then one of those patients in his home, they found black mold. And that was the boom. That was the moment that it was like, okay, I think this might be what's behind your barriers to getting better. And the more that I dug into mold, the more I found that was true. And then wondered if it also applied to those other, you know, quote unquote, stuck patients that were trying so hard and doing everything right but not getting better. And sure enough, there were evidences of water damage building and mold exposure in their history.
So when you say you dug into mold.
Yeah.
what do you mean by that?
Mold is it's very well known in the research world. We understand this in animal husbandry. People who take care of animals and feed animals, they had to figure out mold because they were losing entire livestock because of mold infecting their food. So we started to understand it not only from an environmental perspective, but also from a feed standpoint. But research on humans is really lacking. So we don't really have good research on what kind of things will make a person better if they have mold exposure. Of course, the number one thing if you have mold exposure is avoidance. In my book, I talk about that, the the first three things to do, avoidance, avoidance, avoidance. So you kind of get the picture of how important that is. If you don't get out of the moldy environment, there's no amount of band-aiding and chasing we can do to get somebody better. So that's the first thing. And in some cases, that works. People get out of the environment and they get better. But in some cases, they don't get better. And it's because the mold has now altered their immune system and has kind of moved into their body. And that's where we come in as doctors to help out.
When people think of mold, everybody has a specific idea of what that is, you know, spores that can kind of get into your body. But what are the different types of mold that people encounter on a daily basis?
That's a really good point to bring up, because people associate mold illness with an old building where it smells musty. You can tell that there's visual mold. But in many of the cases that I worked with, there was no evidence of the mold. The most toxic part of mold has no scent. And that is the part that can move through building materials. Those are called mycotoxins, mold toxins. You can be breathing that air and having the exposure and getting ill from things that have nothing to do with the spores. So I think of mold illness as a math equation. It's both spore illness plus mycotoxin illness and chemical illness. So mold also spits out chemicals like VOCs and things that you would have in new materials. Some people really are intolerant to those, so now that's another piece of their toxicity that's piled on top of their problem.
Is there a specific place in a home or in a building more generally that you're going to find mold?
Any water intrusion. Okay. I would say in our area where it's so humid, and then we have these uber-tight homes, we have a real recipe for disaster. All of the building materials we're using are lined in paper, which is mold's favorite food. It's an easy to digest carbohydrate. So we line our house with paper. We don't manage humidity. Mold can grow at over 50% humidity. Think about that. Like in our area, in the summertime, we can be at 80 to 90% humidity day after day after day. So if you're not doing something to actively reduce your humidity, mold can grow because you have a tight home made of paper on the inside, and all that humidity. But I would say most commonly, the building biologist that I work with who does the mold inspection, she has yet to see a finished basement that doesn't have some degree of mold growth.
Hmm.
Whoa. Now, is that enough mold growth to be affecting the people inside or the animals inside? Maybe not, but she's finding it in every building she looks.
So if you're someone who is having an issue with mold, how do you know? What are the kinds of symptoms that you're going to have?
That's the really tricky thing about mold. It doesn't have a diagnostic symptom. And that's why I think it has gone unrecognized for so long and why I wrote the book, because I wanted to create an awareness about all the various ways that mold can show up. It can affect every system in the body, and it can create almost any symptom because it depends on your genetic weaknesses. So you might come from a family that has a lot of irritable bowel disease, and then if you move into a water-damaged office and you start getting worse irritable bowel symptoms, you can say, well, this is my family dynamics and it's stress. But that's why I created the questionnaire in the book, because I wanted to give people an idea of a risk factor. You know, taking all of the things that mold could be creating and comparing it to all of the things you might be noticing in your body and give you a risk of, yeah, it's probably not mold. It's probably something else. Maybe it's diet, lifestyle, things that we can address. And then there's high-risk people and then somewhere in between. So it gives you a way to know. I would say the number one thing that we see is fatigue. That can be masked with our hypercaffeine use in our culture, and also some level of anxiousness, some level of inner unsettled feeling. I would say that of all of the people I've worked with that had mold, those were two factors. And it doesn't have to be crippling fatigue, although it could be, depending on your genetics, how long you've been exposed and how much you've been exposed to. But it's a marked change in your normal way of being.
A lot of the symptoms on the questionnaire also correlate with various autoimmune disorders, autoimmune problems. How do you dissect mold from those kinds of issues, and should you?
That's a really astute observation that you made. the reason why a lot of the things on the questionnaire address autoimmune is that mold will create an immune deficiency in the body. And if you look at other congenital types of immune deficiencies, the number one thing that they get is more infections, which you can see with mold. The number two thing they get is more autoimmune disease. So the autoimmune disease, I see it as immune confusion and exhaustion. So it's just firing off at anything because it's just, it doesn't have the distinction and the energy anymore to figure out what to freak out about, basically. So yeah, you'll see immune deficiency symptoms, and then you can have an increased incidence of autoimmune conditions.
So your book is, of course, called Break the Mold, 5 Tools to Conquer Mold. What are some of those tools? If you're someone who believes that you are having these kinds of issues, or someone who already has autoimmune problems that aren't going away, what can you do to combat mold, at least?
Mm-hmm. Well, the 5 tools in general are avoidance, which we talked about. Get out of the mold and get away from it in your food, get away from it in your environment, your hobbies. You would not believe how many people I worked with that have mold toxicity that were attracted to things as their hobby that just made their mold symptoms worse. So we have historic building people that love to go stay in historic buildings and tour historic buildings. Brewmaster, I had librarian. I mean, it's, and that's just a bunch of paper. It's amazing to me, the hobbies. So avoidance, number one. Number two, fundamentals. Getting all of the fundamental things that you would get lectured from a naturopathic doctor like me, like eating right, exercise, getting sleep, healthy relationships, you know, blah, blah. Number three is protecting your body from that exposure. Repairing any damage is number 4. And number 5 is then kill the mold. So in each of those tools, there are various things that you can pick and choose that match what you're willing to do. And not everybody needs to use every single tool, but you do need to use something from each of those 5 categories in order to break the mold.
So if you are someone, though, who's a librarian, that's your job,
mm-hmm.
what do you do? Because, I mean, you can't, you maybe can't stop being a librarian if that's how you're, you know,
making
your livelihood. If there are elements of your life where you really have to encounter mold, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, so one of those situations is remediators. They do heroic work. They go into these water-damaged buildings. They know there's mold there. They wear all of the protective gear, but the toxins can get through their mask. So they have to be doing things to protect their bodies. So that entire section, protect, has like bioflavonoids. Those are the colorful parts of food that help to protect the effects of those toxins coming into the body. Not everybody is going to be genetically as sensitive as another person. Many of the remediators that worked on my home and have worked on homes of my patients, they kind of look at people like me that are what I call a mold canary in the coal mine because I react to everything mold. They would look at me and think, oh, I'm so glad I'm not that lady. You know, and they're much more hardy and they can handle being exposed to that. But I still lectured them, poor guys, about taking milk thistle because that has a specific benefit for mold exposure. And there has to be a certain amount in your system. So there are things that you can do that even if you know you're going to be exposed. Now, number one for them, they do protective equipment. That's the most important thing that they're doing. But also from a body standpoint, getting your body more resilient to that exposure. If you are a librarian, for example, and you're in a moldy library, remediation also has to happen. That's the complex part about mold, is that I can do everything to help the body, but then we need other building doctors to come and treat the building to really treat the cause.
All right. Well, Jill, thank you so much for coming in and talking about your book with us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Jill Krista is a naturopathic doctor based in Janesville and the author of a new book entitled Break the Mold, 5 Tools to Conquer Mold and Take Back Your Health. She spoke with Lake Effect producer Joy Powers.
Dr. Krista has a survey available on her website for those who are concerned whether mold is impacting their health. You can find a link to that survey at WUWM.com.
We'll take another quick break now, and then our sports contributor talks with us about the Green Bay Packers' abrupt hiring of a new head coach this week. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The last time we spoke with sports contributor Sean Ramft, the Green Bay Packers had just fired longtime coach Mike McCarthy in the midst of a second consecutive mediocre season and replaced him on an interim basis with Joe Philbin. The season did not get any better, and the Packers missed out on the playoffs by a lot.
This week, after reportedly considering many high-profile names to replace McCarthy, the Packers hired someone who was more under the radar, Tennessee Titans offensive coordinator Matt LaFleur. And Sean Ramft is back in the studio with us to talk about this latest move at Lambeau Field. Nice to see you, Sean.
Thanks for having me again.
So, Sean, this was a pretty quick hire, wasn't it?
Yes. I feel like that might be the biggest criticism anyone can have of it right now. I see a lot of people already a little worried about, you know, the actual hire because of his offense last season. I'm not looking at any of that. I know Matt LaFleur was the offensive coordinator of the Tennessee Titans last season, or this past season, and their offense wasn't good. There's a lot of factors that went into that, though, so I'm not really going to worry about that, because you can also point to his experience with Matt Ryan in Atlanta during his MVP season, Robert Griffin III during his Rookie of the Year season in Washington. He was with the Rams last season when their offense turned a corner, and Jared Goff posted an excellent season as well. So he seems to do fine with good quarterbacks, with talented quarterbacks. But yeah, it seemed to happen really quickly.
Right, they went from interviewing him to hiring him in less than a day, right?
And they had, I want to say, almost a dozen names. They interviewed a couple. I know they interviewed New England Patriots offensive coordinator Josh McDaniels and maybe a few other names, but then they started calling everybody and said, hey, we've got our guy. And maybe that's how high on him they are.
Clearly something must have come up in the interview, right, that led them to believe this is the perfect fit for right now.
Right. Again, that's the only criticism I think I would have as someone looking at this from the outside is, wow, that didn't take long at all. Granted, they did get a 4-week or so head start when they let Mike McCarthy go. So maybe they had been penciling him in a little stronger than we would think over the past week.
What was it that made hiring an offensive coordinator such an important part of the process for the Packers?
I think it comes down to what you want to get out of Aaron Rodgers. We've seen this more and more in recent weeks that he's had a lot of trouble also, and no one wanted to say it until after after Green Bay let McCarthy go. There was always, you know, whispers and like, oh, you know, maybe it's both of them. But if you look at a lot of his numbers this season, his completion percentage is way down. And that is one thing that LaFleur with the Titans this past season excelled at. There's a statistic called expected completion percentage, and they were up near 69%, which would be great. He also had to deal with quarterbacks like Marcus Mariota, who was hurt all the time, and Blaine Gabbert was his backup, who is not very good. So he had that to work with. With Rodgers, though, it's a lot of holding on to the ball too long. You saw a lot of complaints about the Packers' offensive line, but in the last couple of weeks, their offensive line has ranked near the top on almost every list I've seen, and yet he was sacked over 50 times because he held on to the ball, he didn't trust his receivers, any combination of things. He had a lot of throwaways also. It seems like they need someone to get in his ear. I don't know if that is going to be LaFleur. It's going to have to be LaFleur, but I don't know. That's the thing. You can't really judge this hire until you see literally anything that happens. It's weird to think that he's only a few years older than Aaron Rodgers. He's 39 years old. So hopefully a fresh face and some new experience will kickstart something. But it starts with Rodgers, too. We saw him trust Davante Adams a lot over the last couple seasons and Geronimo Allison this season when he was healthy. But while they got pretty decent production out of their rookie receivers like Valdez Scantling and
Equanimeous St. Brown.
And St. Brown, he still has these issues with new receivers where he will not throw them the ball. For whatever reason, it's a big trust issue with him. It's been that way for years, though. And he just need to find someone who's going to make him change these things.
And so would you say that as LaFleur comes in, he's going to be charged with making over the offense or just taking better advantage of what offense is already there?
I want to say both. I guess that's a cop-out answer. They definitely need to alter how they do things. As we saw, Mike McCarthy was the primary play caller for years, and it seems to have gotten a little stale. With Tennessee, they ran the ball a lot. They had a top 10 ranked run offense, and I know in today's NFL, the rush offense isn't as much of a priority as it used to be, but if you have talented running backs, you need to utilize them. And the Packers have Aaron Jones, who led the league in yards per carry this past season, and Jamal Williams, who in Jones's absence did pretty well and is a great pass blocker. And one thing LaFleur does a lot is he creates plays where the halfback catches a lot of passes, and that's something that the Packers don't do a lot. Aaron Jones picked it up a little bit or seemed to get more targets as the season went on, but McCarthy doesn't run a lot of plays for running backs to catch passes, or Aaron Rodgers doesn't like checking the ball down. There's a lot of things for LaFleur to look at because, again, you have someone who's talented in Aaron Jones. You have Aaron Rodgers, who's one of the most talented quarterbacks to ever play. You should just use what you have. It's really easy to look at the best example there is, and it's Tom Brady in New England, where he'll throw the ball to James White 10 to 15 times a game. Maybe it's not always the prettiest thing, and it doesn't always lead to huge plays, but it's an option that you need to take advantage of. So LaFleur is going to definitely have to overhaul a bit of the offense, but he's got some talent to work with. So the biggest thing is just making these adjustments for Rodgers and finding the right guy who will make Rodgers make these adjustments.
How long a leash do you think Matt LaFleur has?
I want to say
if they go 9-7 next year.
I want to say if they go 9-7 next year, he'll be fine. They gave him a 4-year contract with an option for a fifth, which obviously in any sports landscape means nothing when you're a coach, especially it seems like in the NFL when success is, you know, necessary immediately and consistently. But this will be his first head coaching job. 9-7 should probably keep his job. I know it'll be disappointing for Packers fans to see 9-7, but they had a really rough year.
Right, so, 9-7 would be an improvement.
And I think more importantly than the record is just how it looks or how they look, because there were so many games this past season where
they weren't even competitive,
it wasn't
right?
clicking. They came out flat constantly. I feel like, though, if he doesn't reach the playoffs in the first two seasons, then you could probably see him being on the hot seat of sorts. But now you have a problem with the division is getting better. The Chicago Bears, their offense isn't fantastic, but they have an all-world defense, and they just ran away with the division at the end of the year.
They could use a new kicker.
They could use a new kicker. They'll probably be doing that. The Vikings had a weirdly disappointing season. I don't understand where they're at. Maybe they weren't as good as we thought they were last season. I don't know. But the division is a little bit more competitive than it has been in recent years when the Packers won it all the time. So I'd say 2 years for sure he'd get. But if they go 9-7 next season and then regress, I feel like that'd be it.
So we talked about Matt LaFleur's leash. What about Aaron Rodgers? Is he quarterback for life?
He, right now, with that extension, he definitely is the quarterback until barring, you know, another injury that keeps him out for more than a half a season or
There's
something.
There's no Joe Montana going to the Kansas City Chiefs at the end of his career?
No,
kind of thing,
not at this point. I feel like if they wouldn't have given him that extension, they had a couple seasons to play around with that before inking that one. But it is what it is. You're not...
I mentioned Joe Montana. I could easily have mentioned Brett Favre.
Right. Yeah, I don't see a Brett Favre scenario happening unless he gets, you know... if he regresses so badly in the next couple of years where they have to just move on. But I don't see that happening. The ability is still clearly there. He's just picked up a couple of bad habits, and he just needs to adjust that. The biggest thing is he's been around for a while now. He's in his mid-30s. He's been playing at a high level for a while. It's going to be tough to get through to him on a couple of those things.
All right, so at this stage, the Packers are on to next year and what Matt LaFleur can accomplish. What are you seeing in the playoffs so far this year?
Honestly, I think the Chargers could surprise a couple people. The Ravens game was weird. It was really uneventful for most of the game until the fourth quarter, and they almost let it get away. But they haven't lost on the road. Technically, they lost a road game this season. It was to the Rams in Los Angeles. I don't think that really counts as much.
They are playing the Patriots, who have not lost at home.
That is true. And I hear there is snow in the forecast. So it's, you know, it's probably going to be, obviously, it's the toughest for the Chargers. I feel like they'd match up better against the Chiefs, even though the Chiefs are great. You can really almost rarely bet against the Patriots in the playoffs until we see something where they just don't lose. I don't think the Eagles are going to keep doing this. I don't think Nick Foles is going to keep leading these late last minute drives to win football games. If Parkey doesn't miss that field goal on Sunday, we're not talking about Nick Foles. And I'm not taking anything away from Nick Foles, who was sensational last season and once again has filled in admirably this season with Carson Wentz hurt. I think the Saints are my NFC pick.
And for Wisconsin sports fans, it's on to Bucks season.
Hey, you got the Bucks. They're doing great. They're one of the best teams in the East, and you can anticipate the Brewers, who are coming off an excellent season as well. So for the first time, for anyone who also watches more than just the Packers, there's actual other sports to be happy about and excited about, which isn't always the case.
Sean, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Sean Ramft is Lake Effect's regular sports contributor. He talked with us about the new Packers head coach, Matt LaFleur. You can find our past conversations with him at WUWM.com.
Our film contributor joins us, and we meet the guy behind the music in the new Mary Poppins film when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Even though the new film Mary Poppins Returns took home no honors at the recent Golden Globe Awards, the film has still been hugely successful at the box office, earning upwards of $100 million since its release last month.
And while audiences doubted whether Emily Blunt and Lin-Manuel Miranda could fill the original film's sizable shoes, the sequel has charmed audiences and many critics alike. We'll be joined in a little while by the songwriter and composer behind the new film, Mark Shaiman. But first, Lake Effect film critic Ryan Jay joins Audrey Nowakowski.
Ryan Jay, welcome back to Lake Effect.
I'm glad to be back, and I'm so excited to be talking about Mary Poppins Returns because it is my second favorite movie of 2018. It was my first favorite until I saw Welcome to Marwen, which is a must-see also, but this movie, Mary Poppins Returns, you have to see in the theater. It's outstanding.
Yes, and in my opinion, it's like it's a spoonful of sugar everybody needs.
Yes.
Because we all need some medicine right now.
It's so true. Or I was thinking, you know, everybody's, you know, she says practically perfect in every way. I think this movie is actually perfect in every way.
Yeah. And it's a surprising thing that it works so well because this was such a big task.
There are very big shoes to fill, but you have director Rob Marshall here, who is the, you know, biggest heavy hitter in Hollywood right now directing movie musicals. So there's a lot of confidence there. But I think what's so amazing about this as a sequel is that it pays homage to the original, but is still very modern and fresh in its own way. And, you know, it would previously be blasphemous to think that how can you touch a property or recast Mary Poppins because Julie Andrews is so iconic in the role. But Emily Blunt makes the role her own, and it nods to the original, but it still, you know, modernizes it in a way that it's just kind of mind-blowing.
Right, and I think it adds a little depth because Rob Marshall wanted this version of Mary Poppins more so based off of the original character written by P.L. Travers in the books. So She's a little more eccentric. You know, not that she wasn't in the first film, but, you know, having the constant contrary psychology, the, you know, little bit of mischief that she wants people to get in, yet while being a little strict with some things.
Totally. And I think also something else that comes hand in hand is you have a little bit of the iconic Mary Poppins musical themes from the original film in the score, hidden sort of within the score. And you hear those at very poignant moments in this film. And we spoke with songwriter and composer Mark Shaiman about his work on this film. And we're going to share that interview coming up in a little bit. But these songs are so incredible because again, they are completely in the style and tone of what the Sherman Brothers did in the original film, but still stand alone as their own works of great art.
Absolutely. And I can't tell you like how refreshing it was for me to sit through an overture at the beginning of a
yes.
film again.
It's beautiful. And also the choreography in some of these, you know, it's like we had the chimney sweeps in the first one. Here they're lamplighters. But it was the first time I've seen where I wish I could get up and have like leapt into the film and like joined them in this dance. It's so exciting. It was just so athletic and cool. And I just wish I could move like that.
Right. And despite this film being set during, they call it the Great Slump, and it's always very dark and foggy and gray, except when you go into these fantastical worlds of Mary Poppins. And one thing that a Mary Poppins movie can't be without is some animation.
Right.
And I was so excited to see that they actually went into the archives of how they were drawing the penguins for this film. And the people were hand-drawing, recreating the style of animating that sequence.
Yes, so much of family entertainment now and animation is the CGI animation. So to see it go back to the original hand-drawn animation is fantastic and really steps back in time to what we experienced with the first Mary Poppins, and we have that here. And I love how colorful it is. And I also have never seen costumes like this where they look like they're hand-drawn but wearable animated
actual
art.
Yeah, fabric. Yeah.
It was so unique and so different and so worthy of awards attention and consideration because you've never seen anything quite like that before.
Along with that sequence, we have, amidst many, many songs that are in this film, but Lin-Manuel Miranda has his own, a few mm-hmm. solo acts within this movie. What did you think of his performance and the fact that maybe he's bringing over newer audiences to a classic musical style?
He's amazing. He's Broadway royalty. So when you're getting, you know, Rob Marshall, who's movie musical royalty, combining with Broadway's best, and then you throw in, you know, Meryl Streep and Emily Blunt and the rest of the outstanding cast, there are also some, you know, we don't want to do spoilers, but there are some surprises in the movie as well in the casting. But Lin is so great because I didn't get to see him in Hamilton when I saw that show, but that show and his genius is very evident. And he has a couple Hamilton-esque moments in this film that are still very proper to Mary Poppins' tone. So it was kind of very exciting to see him get to play with that. The whole movie gives you a sense of joy, and it has beat for beat kind of follows where the original went, but also perks you up. And I feel like it's the kind of movie that at any point in your life either takes you back to your childhood as an adult or totally whisks you away as a child and taps into that spirit of imagination and happiness and what could be.
Yeah, and this film, you know, not that it's dark per se, but the children have lost their mother. They're about to lose the house. So, of course, the big arc where Mary Poppins comes in to save the day is to help the family, you know, keep their home and all of that. But compared to the first film, it is a bit darker in theme because a lot of people in modern world can connect to some of the struggles being portrayed in this film.
Absolutely. And I think also part of what tugs at your heartstrings, and there are several moments in the film where you sort of get teary-eyed, and I think it's due partially to the music, again, because there are really sort of melancholic, beautiful ballads that are very touching and deep and poetic, and
yeah.
I loved that.
Yeah, and it wasn't surprising, but I did not know Emily Blunt could sing that well.
Right. Yeah, she does one better even than what we heard her do in Into the Woods. And so it's thrilling to hear her open up and really go there and to see Meryl Streep play again that way and everyone else that sings in the movie. Ben
right.
Whishaw, as the father here, has a great voice too.
Mm-hmm. And we have a little Disney royalty blip at the end. Again, it's kind of a theme with this one, but Angela Lansbury gets to sing a whole song at mm-hmm. the end to conclude the movie. And like you said before, it kind of brings you back to that nostalgia, classic Disney moment, because you can't think of Angela Lansbury not like feel some sort of comfort.
Totally. She was the voice of Mrs. Potts. She did Bedknobs and Broomsticks. And it's that Disney magic that only they can do. And you see it, and it's so thrilling that they did it now, because, you know, if they waited much longer, they might not have the opportunity to do it. So there's something that's absolutely powerful. It's that lightning in a bottle of her in this Disney movie with this color in the Mary Poppins film. It's just magical.
Right. And do you think that this came at the right time, too, just overall? I mean, it's in times for award season, so of course it gets in those nominations that it needs. But, I would have never thought that we needed another Mary Poppins until you see this, and then it's confirmed with your eyes.
It's true. It's also challenging to think, like, how do you go back to something that's so classic and consider possibly redoing it? Because you can't. How can you refill the shoes of Julie Andrews? You can't. But this movie works in a way that gives me confidence that if somebody wanted to go back and remake or do a proper sequel to The Wizard of Oz or other movies that you think would be impossible to redo, if you got a team like this behind it, you can do it, because they did it in a way, again, that honors the original but still makes this new one their own and doesn't take away from what the original meant to people.
Right. As you mentioned before, a big part of that is because of the power of the music, honoring that style as well. So let's go over to our interview with songwriter and composer Mark Shaiman, who joined us by the phone. He first starts by answering my question about what was the first Mary Poppins song he learned to play by the Sherman Brothers and how they influenced him as a songwriter and composer.
Well, I guess I learned all the songs at the same time, but Feed the Birds was probably the one that, you know, teaching little fingers like a young, I was 4 years old when the movie came out. I imagine that song was probably easiest to play. But, you know, I devoured that record for my entire childhood and most of my adulthood as well. I mean, it meant so much to me. The music and lyrics that I learned, the way to write a song I learned from the Sherman Brothers, and the way to orchestrate and score a movie I learned from a man whose name is not as well known, who is Erwin Kostel. And he was this music supervisor, music director, orchestrator of the Mary Poppins, as well as Sound of Music. So that man was a genius. These are gods to me. And I learned everything I could ever want to know from listening to that record endlessly. And then I went off and grew up and had my own career and learned an awful lot, scoring a lot of movies and writing Broadway musicals like Hairspray.
Yes.
And then Mary Poppins Returns came up, and it was my chance to just combine everything that I've ever learned into this one movie.
Well, and how much of a challenge was it to actually strike that tone of the Sherman Brothers? I mean, your music, that's what's so amazing about Mary Poppins Returns, is that, you know, it's fresh and original, but yet has the same tone as what the Sherman Brothers did.
Well, the hard part was how intimidating that was, to know that we would be judged against that, because let's face it, it's the greatest song score ever written for an original musical, you know, movie musical. But because we grew up with it, it is so in my DNA. That was very much why Rob Marshall, you know, chose Scott and I to write these songs and for me to score the movie. He knew, just by talking to me and watching my reaction to listening to the original soundtrack, he just knew that it was in my blood, it was in my bone, in my soul. So I didn't really have to do any research or anything. It came very naturally to write in a style that at least sounded like it still lived on Cherry Tree Lane. And we didn't try to imitate the songs. And, of course, we didn't try to write a new song that had a 32-letter, very hard-to-say word. we knew we couldn't try to compare ourselves like that way. But at least making it sound like it's in the same neighborhood.
Right.
So it's not jarring. Like, you could watch the first movie and then watch our movie and feel a continuity.
Totally.
Absolutely. And there's continuity with Mary as well, even though it's two different actresses. And of course, the highest of standards is set by Julie Andrews. But with Emily Blunt's rendition, and with Mary's first song in the film, is Can You Imagine That? So what musical impression did you want to give audiences for their first reintroduction to the character Mary?
First wrote a song for that spot. We wrote a song that was very much in the style of the 1930s English dance band, because we thought, well, let's let Mary Poppins go. She knows which era she has now landed in. But we kept writing different songs, and finally we thought, let's not shy away from sounding like it's a Mary Poppins movie. And so the song we ended up with, Can You Imagine That, certainly sounds like in the style of the first movie.
Some people like to splash and play, can you imagine that? And take a seaside holiday, can you imagine that? Too much glee leaves rings around the brain. Take that joy and send it down the drain. Some people like to laugh at life and giggle through the day. They think the world's a brand new shiny toy.
And like the first movie, we also saw that Mary Poppins is the
queen of reverse psychology. In the first movie, she sings the song Stay Awake, a lullaby called Stay Awake, which every lyric is telling the kids, don't lie your head on the pillow, stay awake. And, of course, that puts them right to sleep. So with our song, Can You Imagine That?, she is scoffing at the use of imagination. Like, why would you want to use your imagination and think of all the wonderful, fun things a child could do? And yet she's also saying, can you imagine that? Can you? Can right. you, you know, that use your imagination and think of these things? And so by the end of the song, she has gotten them to open up to her about her own imagination.
It's so clever. And working with Lin-Manuel Miranda, you've got Broadway royalty there. So he had a couple moments in this film that were his own musical style. Did he collaborate in those sort of Hamilton-type moments, or did you just find the thrill in writing that for him?
Well, no, we were thrilled to be able to write that. Luckily, the time period of the movie is perfect for the English music hall style of patter songs. It's existed for, you know, for centuries. Gilbert and Sullivan were probably the grandfathers of rap. You know, the I am the very model of a modern major general. I mean, that kind of stuff has existed for over 100 years. So we were able to write for Lin something that would give the audience what they wanted to hear. And Lin was very happy to be an actor and a dancer and a performer and leave the writing to someone else. Just written Hamilton, which is, you know, you can imagine what how much work that was. And he was like, fellas, you build the boat and I'll go sailing on it. And him having that confidence in us was extremely helpful for us.
School, like you'll be a happy king if you enjoy the things you've got. You should never try to be the kind of person that you're not. So they sang and they laughed when the king had found a friend, and they ran onto a rainbow for the story's perfect end. So the moral is you mustn't let the outside be the guide, for it's not so cut and dried. Well, unless it's Dr. Jekyll, then you better hide. Petrified! No, the truth can't be denied, as I now have testified. All that really counts and matters is the special stuff inside.
If you have time for one more quick question, I'm curious, which song are you most proud of, and does that change day to day?
It changes day to day. I mean, it's hard. You know, they're all your little babies, and you got to love them all. Even though it's not a song that's been put up for, you know, award consideration, the last song in the movie, There's Nowhere to Go But Up, is a very important song to us because it kind of speaks to our current world situation. And hopefully, you know, it's the most glass half full version of looking at how things are nowadays, and to say, well, there's nowhere to go but up is a very positive way to look at our current life.
Well, and to have Angela Lansbury be the head of that song is amazing.
Hey, I still cannot believe it. I swear to you, I still can't believe it that it's happened. When I hear her singing words I wrote and melodies I wrote, I just can't believe it.
It's amazing. Thank you so much. You're brilliant.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Life's a balloon that tumbles or rises depending on what is inside.
Mark Shaiman is the songwriter and composer for Mary Poppins Returns. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and film contributor Ryan Jay by phone. And you can find more of our film segments at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.